Morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourself around this wonderful world. Welcome back to the TDSIG, the Teacher Development Special Interest Group Developer Podcast. We're very lucky today to listen to Helen Slee, a former winner of the Michael Bergman Scholarship. And Helen will tell you all about that scholarship and her incredible journey at IATEFL last year in Belfast, so the IATEFL conference. And hang on to the end of the program to listen out for how you can also apply for and potentially win, like Helen, an all-expenses-paid trip to the conference. Okay, without further ado, over to Helen. Welcome, Helen. So, Helen, how did you win the scholarship exactly, and what has it meant for you?
Sure. So as a member of ITEFL and TDSIG, I keep abridged of their social media posts and notices. So I applied for the Michael Bergman Scholarship a few days before the deadline. A friend of mine had won a MOSIG scholarship the previous year and had told me what a great experience she had. So I thought, well, if I don't apply, if I don't try, I'll never know. So I applied and answered the questions, did a little write-up of a story of my teaching. I didn't really expect to win because I thought there would be a lot of competition, but I was really surprised when I did win and really pleased. And getting this scholarship meant that I could access ITEFL. I'd never attended before. Because of the scholarship, I was able to attend at no financial cost to myself. Yeah.
So remind me, I believe as part of the scholarship, you get the conference included plus £1,000 in expenses.
Yes,
is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that £1,000 covered my flights to and from Belfast, the stay at the hotel, and any of my expenses during the week. So eating costs, etc. In the end, I think after I had tallied it up, I had only spent £10 of my own money.
Wow.
The rest of it was covered by the scholarship, which was amazing.
Excellent. Excellent. So the scholarship can't be sneezed at. I'll tell the listeners at the end of the program how to apply for this year's scholarship. Great. So what were your expectations of the ITEFL conference? And did the experience really match your expectations?
Absolutely. Well, I expected to learn some new things, new approaches or tasks or ideas. I expected to relearn some things that I'd heard about or researched, read about before. And, oh, yeah, that I haven't tried that yet. Or I tried that and it didn't work. Maybe if I do it in a different way. And I expected to maybe practice unlearning a few things. I think all of us teachers have those habits we want to unlearn or change or improve. And so it's nice to sometimes talk to other professionals about their habits or what they unlearned and how they did it. A really great thing about this conference was after 2 years of solely online communication with fellow like-minded professionals, I got to meet a lot of people that I had a personal or professional relationship with online through social media, but I had never met in person. So it was really nice to, you know, meet these people face to face and to network. And I mean, it's enjoyable. The conference, I expected it to be enjoyable, and it really was. It was nice to, you know, make professional connections, but also to socialize too.
Okay. Yeah. It's one of the best things about IATEFL, I think, actually mixing with real people, right? And especially when you've been really in touch online. And then put a face to an avatar, as you say, or, you know, even if you've seen somebody in a webinar, then it's not quite the same. And it's almost like, have I met you before? When you meet in person, it's tallying the two, the physical form and the online presence. It's quite important, I think.
That actually happened to me. I met a woman who I had seen a webinar, an IATEFL webinar by, and I was like, I'm sure, have we spoken online? And we were trying to figure out how we knew each other. And then I realized, oh, you gave that great webinar last year about...
And in fact, I'd seen you doing a webinar as part of the TDSIG Web Carnival a little while back. And we'd arranged to meet later in the day at IATEFL. And then we found ourselves sitting next to each other, didn't we?
Yeah.
We were literally sitting next to each other.
We happened to choose the same talk. It was Danny Norrington Davis and Chin on emergent language, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Really interesting talk.
So in terms of what you hope to learn, what did you hope to focus on, perhaps?
Sure. Well, an area where I pretty much always identify as an area of growth for me is pronunciation, teaching methods, all of its different aspects, not just, you know, teaching individual phonetic sounds, but also things like sentence stress, word stress, intonation. That's been a weakness for me as a teacher for a long time. So I attended the PRONSIG pre-conference event, which was fantastic. It was the first day and it was really great to dig into this topic. And I was actually pleasantly surprised with all the things that I was relearning, as I mentioned before, but some really great new ideas as well. And it was really nice to brainstorm with other teachers, some who felt quite confident with pronunciation, others who, like me, are sort of in progress. So that was really good.
And putting you on the spot a little bit, let's dig a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. What did you learn specifically from that PRONSIG, the Pronunciation Special Interest Group, PCE Day?
Sure. I mean, they had four different speakers focusing on, integrated pronunciation and speaking, pronunciation and reading, pronunciation and listening, pronunciation and writing. And all of them were very interesting. But I think Robin Walker's talk, which was the final one, was really impactful. And he, by the end of his talk, had shown all of us how pronunciation is connected to all of the four skills. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, we can integrate pronunciation into any task, and how important it is for our learners to be understood by others and to understand others, and how like crucial pronunciation is, even though I suppose a lot of teachers don't deal with pronunciation or are a little nervous about dealing with it because they don't know the topic very well. And so he just really like brought home the point that pronunciation is absolutely important for our learners. They need to be intelligible. And they need to be able to cope when they come up against speaking or listening issues, but also how a pronunciation is so important when reading and writing for understanding words and meaning. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it happens often that a learner will come across a word in a text and they don't know the word, and they look it up and, oh, I know what that word sounds like. I've just never seen it written down. Mm-hmm. or vice versa. They mm-hmm. hear a word and think, oh, what the heck is that word? And then they look it up and go, oh, I know exactly what that is when I see it written down. I've never heard it said that way. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was really informative and very interesting. And it was Robin Walker's last talk due to retirement. So that was also a bit of a moment as well.
Mm-hmm. Pivotal moment. Okay, great. So how would your teaching of pronunciation perhaps change as a result of attending that PCE?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in the past, I suppose, like many teachers, often focused on pronunciation in conjunction with speaking and listening. When my learners are working on reading or writing, I almost never connected to pronunciation tasks. So now I think I'm going to focus a lot more on integrating pronunciation extensions and additions into all four types of skill-based tasks with my learners, because I think they would really benefit from it.
Mm-hmm. I used to observe Arabic teachers teaching Arabic pronunciation through reading, and it was very much read aloud strategies. And at the time I questioned it and thought, is that developing those skills, you know, that we teach so often and we've been taught to teach in EFL? Mm-hmm. Reading for gist, reading for detail, reading for inference, mm-hmm. and so on. And then I realized it's a very, very different language, of course, and that it's essentially a phonetic language, but so is English in some respects. And I think we lose that link between reading and pronunciation in English because we assume that there's so much of a disconnect between the written form and the spoken form.
Absolutely. And I teach Arabic learners, so that's a nice connection. But when I used to teach Spanish learners, they used to be so frustrated because, of course, Spanish letters are pronounced as they look. It frustrated them that letters and different letter combinations would sound differently in different words. Yeah, it is interesting the way we can connect pronunciation and reading, writing, vocabulary. And I think that that's an area where I want to develop thanks to the PRONSIG PCE.
Super. Okay. So Helen, tell us about a few other plenaries or workshops you attended and perhaps something about what you learned or gained from each of them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So on Tuesday, Diversity in Materials, There's No Room for Single Stories by Akemi Iwasa, which was part of the GSIG showcase.
The Global Issues SIG, right?
Yes, the Global Issues SIG, yeah. Mm-hmm. Was really informative. It talked a lot about like narratives in ELT and like whose narratives are we sharing? What kind of stories are we valuing? And bringing in the idea of diversity. And are we always telling the same kinds of stories? Are our course books always presenting the same types of narratives? Should we be amending those? Should we be bringing in new narratives? Are those narratives even relevant to our learners?
Presumably the inference being we always bring in the same kind of narratives and they're not very relevant to our learners, right? So we need to amend them, right?
Yeah, that was the idea. And the idea of making sure that all of the stories that we're, you know, teaching our students through are ones that are, you know, applicable to them in their lives, but also ones which, I mean, help them actually learn with stories that they will enjoy, not just teach them a text that, you know, the book says to teach them. And also she talks a lot about learners sharing their own diverse stories. And she talked about how it was really easy to bring diversity into the classroom this way when you considered that. Yeah, it was a really good talk. Yeah.
And what did diversity and perhaps intersectionality mean to the presenter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she talked a lot about how we present diversity in our lessons. So she talked about two approaches. She talked about the usualizing approach and she talked about the disruptive approach. And in the usualizing approach, you present narratives as if they're usual, normal. Some people might be familiar with the term normalizing. And, you know, we talked about how, you know, we don't need to normalize diverse stories because they are normal. They are normal. That's the point. We need to usualize them. So when we present a diverse a narrative, maybe a story that a type of person that maybe our learners may not be familiar with or might be a little different from them, she talked about presenting that as if it's usual, because it is. It is normal, so we don't need to normalize it. But by usualizing, we just present it the way it is. And and in a disruptive approach, she talked about how you might use a narrative to disrupt preconceived notions that learners might have about those types of people or those ideas in particular. And she talked about like various different types of diversity and ways that learners might react. And it was really, really interesting.
I guess these themes have been around for the last 2 or 3 years, at least at conference. And actually, we bring exploring threads of diversity and usualizing / normalizing approach versus disruptive via the TDSIG Web Carnival, for instance, and the work of Tyson Seaborn. What was a take home from that workshop for you? How would you do things differently, if at all? Yeah.
Well, the number one thing that it pointed out to me is that a lot of the texts and stories that we are given in the mainstream materials just are not really useful or learning moments for our learners. So teachers and institutions really have a responsibility to try to diversify and meet other learners. For example, I teach Arabic learners. They don't celebrate New Year's Eve. So why am I reading three different texts about New Year's Eve experiences and asking them to write about a New Year's Eve experience when they don't celebrate New Year? You know, we need to make sure that the things that we present to our learners are things which they can actually relate to and apply to their lives. And otherwise, what's the point of doing them? If the learning's not meaningful, then, you know, will they remember it? Will they recall it? Will they reuse it? Yeah, go ahead.
And do you think teachers generally, or institutions for that matter, generally have time to create materials to ensure that there's a broad approach and diversity within materials?
That is an excellent point, which was also brought up in the talk, you know, and right now this area is growing. A lot of materials writers are actually creating and sharing more diverse materials. For example, the Raise Up for ELT program. Akemi herself shared some materials that she had been working on. I know Tyson Seaborn has shared some. Peter Folger has been sharing some as well, especially now for Pride Month. So, but the thing is, a lot of teachers don't have time to create their own materials and or curate. And so,
And these organizations, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're fairly small and amazingly well-meaning organizations, but they're quite small organizations that not everyone has heard of or has access to.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the main publishers, are they doing it, do you think?
Yeah, that is a good question. I attended a webinar last year where we were discussing this exact point. Some materials writers who work with publishers were sort of saying in the comments, we understand your call for diversity. And, you know, we and publishers are working on this, but it just takes time for things to be published. And so, yeah, I mean, the book I'm teaching with, for example, was updated in 2019. It's not very diverse in a lot of ways. It still doesn't teach the singular they pronoun, for example, which is silly, amongst other things. So, I mean, 2019 is not that long ago. It's only for 3 years. Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, we're going to have to wait another few years for new editions of books to come out. So there is some discussion of, well, more diverse materials are coming, but we'll have to see, won't we?
yeah, we sure will. It seems to be that one possible way forward is the localization of course books and creating them for national or even regional markets. And that way they can be diversified. And a course book that's useful and appropriate and possible even in Saudi Arabia, let's say, is going to be very different from something that will be useful or possible in Canada or the UK or even part of those countries. So maybe that's the way forwards. We shall see.
Yeah.
So any other useful plenaries or workshops that you attended?
Yeah. Another really great talk I attended, which surprised me because it wasn't what I was expecting at all, was To Be: The Influence of Performed Discursive Identities in ELT. It was a talk by Michelle Sherpa, and it was part of the IPNSIG.
Do you want to tell us what that is? I believe it's Inclusive Practices.
Inclusive Practice and
Special Educational Needs.
Special Educational Needs, yeah. Inclusive Practices and Special Educational Needs showcase. I attended a lot of showcase because my thought was a lot of the showcases and smaller talks I found more interesting, more relevant to questions I would ask or things I wanted to learn. And also I felt that some of the bigger speakers, bigger plenaries, Jeremy Harmer did a talk. I didn't attend because I thought, well, Jeremy Harmer has been talking for many, many years, and I'm sure that the things he's going to say here, he will say again, and I can find in another, you know, online or...
Or possibly, with all due respect to Jeremy Harmer and the great stuff that he's done, he might have said before.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I wasn't going to say that, but he said it for me. You know, so yeah, I thought, well, I'd quite like to see some of the people that I definitely won't have seen before and may not see again. And as these aren't recorded, then, you know, it might be my only opportunity. So, yeah. So Michelle Sherpa's To Be: Influence of Performed Discursive Identities in ELT. So from the title, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. This could be a bit about, I come from a dramatic arts background. So I was like, oh, this could be a bit like, you know, role playing in the classroom. And then, oh, but identities, like, I'm a big fan of Judith Butler. And, you know, the ideas of all roles are roles that we play, including like gender as performance. So I was like, oh, this is going to be really interesting. And then I went in and it was completely different from what I thought, because Michelle Sherpa used critical discourse analysis, CDA, to look at power relations in the roles that teachers and students played and the expectations that they had for each other and how that would play out.
Can you give us an example of that, perhaps?
Yeah. So she observed two different classrooms, one online, one face-to-face. And in one classroom, the teacher wanted to create a learner-centered classroom. This teacher was really intent on like encouraging autonomous learning and having an emergent syllabus and these types of things. Meanwhile, that teacher's learners, who were a group from South America, I believe, were not at all interested in that. They wanted an expert who was going to come and tell them what they needed to know and how to do it. And so the teacher started out trying to create a sort of communal learning space on Zoom. And by the end of it, the teacher was absolutely the expert, the leader. That teacher was in charge. They had more power than the learners, like completely different from what they had intended. So all the learners came in with certain expectations for the teacher. But when the teacher sort of presented their expectations, one or two of the learners changed their ideas. They got interested in the idea of, you know, learner-centered and emergent syllabus. They got kind of interested in this idea of being more equal to the teacher rather than the teacher having power over them. But then as the teacher shifted in their role, in their power, based on what the majority of the learners had expected. Those learners who had changed their expectations were left out and eventually rebelled. And the teacher eventually exerted their power over those two learners and shut them down later on in the course. Completely the antithesis to what that teacher had expressed they wanted at the beginning of the course.
What did you take away from that?
Yeah, I thought that that was so interesting, the way that we as people change our roles and change the way we behave depending on the expectations of others. In the second classroom, she had a completely different experience where the teacher went into the classroom wanting to be the leader, expecting to have all the power. And most of the learners were okay with that, but there was one or two who rebelled all the way through the course. And they would have actually full-on like fights in the classroom between the teacher exerting their power over these learners and these learners, you know, fighting against it. But the most interesting thing that Michelle Sherpa noticed was in that face-to-face classroom, at the end of the day, after class finished, they were all laughing and joking and friendly together, as if the role of teacher and the role of learners and the like power differential between them had just fallen away. As soon as class time was finished, they were all friendly and equal again.
With the teacher too.
Yeah, with the teacher too, despite the fact that, you know, 10 minutes before they'd had a full-on confrontation in the classroom. Once the roles of teacher and learner were lifted, they were all friendly with each other. Yeah.
What kind of role do you generally take, or you see yourself as taking in the classroom, would you say?
That is a good question. I think I shift around depending on what we're doing in class. There are a lot. There are times where I'll ask my students, do you want to do this activity or this activity? Or you know, now we've learned all this vocabulary. Now, do you want to listen and repeat in the recording or not? And sometimes they'll be like, yes, I'm not sure about the pronunciation. Or no, they'll be like, no, Helen, we don't want to. But then other times I've done that and it's turned into a full out debate in class where some of them want to do it and some of them don't. And we lose time. So
you put on your authoritarian hat, perhaps, in those cases.
I have to. But the majority of the time I'm not particularly authoritative with my learners unless they're sort of stepping outside of my expectations, I guess. I suppose I go by the it's not a problem until you make it a problem kind of you know, and I never really have, I very rarely have those issues in my class. My learners and I are pretty much in terms of authority and power, we're pretty close. But yeah, it shifts. And I thought that as I say, I wasn't expecting what I got from that talk. But I thought it was very interesting that I sort of enter my classroom with the expectation that power is going to shift. Sometimes I have to turn the floor over to students, right? Because we have to give learners the floor so that they can speak, so they can produce language. And you have to be prepared that sometimes things are going to come out of their mouths that you have to deal with in the moment, right? Dealing with emergent language, or when a learner says something awkward, or you know, like correcting in the moment, those sorts of things. Those are all decisions that we make in the moment. And so, yeah, and sometimes, you know, you have to step back and give the power to a student to let them take the floor. And so it was interesting to see that, you know, these two different teachers who had these very extreme notions of how they were going to teach and how much, like the role they were going to take and how much power they're going to have, they were totally opposite. And the way that they shifted and changed throughout with, I thought was very interesting. Yeah. And so I got a lot out of that talk, which I wasn't very different things than I was expecting.
I think we all have those very different scenarios you have to negotiate, right?
Fascinating. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was a fascinating talk. It was really great. People can also purchase an ebook on Amazon with the same title by Michelle Sherpa about her research and her takeaways.
I'm sure Michelle would be very grateful for that quick plug. Thank you.
No problem.
So I'd love to hear about all of the workshops and plenaries you attended, but perhaps just one or two more.
Well, oh gosh, there are quite a lot. Really great talk, which I attended and I was surprised by how relevant it was to me again, was part of the TD SIG showcase on Thursday. It was 13 fatal feedback errors made by ELT managers by Ben Dobbs. And while this talk was aimed at ELT managers giving feedback to teachers, also all of his tips were really applicable to teachers giving feedback to learners. It was really, really good. He presented these 13 fatal errors, problems that we make, and gave examples, and then gave us a solution for each of them. And the main thing that he did, which I think shocked all of the teachers and managers in the room, was that he said that the sandwich method is a bad idea.
For our listeners who don't know, can you quickly summarize what that is and what's wrong with it, according to the presenter?
Yeah, so the sandwich method for giving feedback is the bread of the sandwich is positive and the the filler in the sandwich is negative. So we say a positive thing, say the things that they did well, and then we give the negative feedback, say the things that need improvement, and then we end with positive feedback again so that they don't take away only the negatives. Now, the problem with this, Ben Dobbs said, is that the first layer of positive feedback at the start is always quite detailed. We give a lot of specific examples. For teachers giving learners feedback, we talk about specific grammar they used well or vocabulary or whatever. And then when we give the negatives in the middle, we talk about things they could improve, the grammar they could do more correctly, or other words they could have used, etc. But then that final positive layer is always really general and ineffective, like something like, great writing piece, I look forward to seeing the next one. The listeners can't see me, but I'm like giving a big wide open smile and a thumbs up, like like an emoji. And that's not really actually that, it doesn't land and stick the way that the previous negative and positive did. So what learners are really taking away is the negative, because that that positive comment, or those positive comments, which are, as I say, normally quite general, because the first layer or initial positive feedback was quite detailed, the last feedback is quite, you know, wishy-washy general, and so it doesn't stick. So what learners really get from the sandwich method feedback is the negative in the middle, because it's the last meaningful feedback they got.
I've heard it said also that the recipient of feedback, whoever it may be, is often listening out for that negative bit in the middle anyway, because they've been so coached into knowing, if you like, that there's going to be this sandwich, and what they want to know is that negative stuff to improve.
Yeah. And so, and that was a bit of an eye opener. And I realized, oh, I do that. Oh, I need to change that, which I think is really great. And also another thing that he really pointed out is empathy. It's really important for managers and teachers who are giving feedback to teachers and learners, that, you know, we need to empathize with the people who we're giving feedback to. You know, obviously we're presenting negative feedback and suggestions for improvement, and we need to present that in a way which is empathetic. And we need to make suggestions and ask them for suggestions as to how they can improve it. A main problem with presenting feedback to someone is you give them the feedback, you know, this is right and this is right and this is right and this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong. And that's it. It needs to become more of a dialogue.
It was
a really good talk. As I say, as I'm not an ELT manager, I'm a teacher, I wasn't sure how applicable it was going to be, but it was very applicable, really interesting. And the general feeling in the room from managers and teachers alike was really positive. I think a lot of them were really like, whoa, actually. We need to be open. That was another thing that he said. We need to be open to getting feedback on our feedback. I sort of alluded to this a bit when he said, you know, that it needed to be a conversation. But also, you know, we need to ask for feedback on our feedback. Teachers need to ask students, was my feedback helpful? What was useful? Is there anything I could do differently or better? And the same with managers to teachers. Was, you know, my feedback on your last performance review actually useful? Like, is there a different things I could do differently which would support you better? That sort of thing. Yeah. And that's hard to do, to open yourself up to criticism as you're there, like giving someone constructive criticism. You also need to open yourselves up to getting their constructive criticism on your constructive criticism for them, which becomes a bit of a tongue twister, but how you have a healthy relationship.
Good. And going back to your previous points, it also assumes a small power differential between the person giving feedback and the person receiving, or at least that can be developed, that dialogue, which you know, in some cases of giving feedback or receiving feedback, there just isn't that possibility. Even if you hand over and say, I'd like some feedback on my feedback, the relationship is such that they won't, or won't give you very useful feedback. So it's one in progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And that would battle the sort of power differential in roles, which of course Michelle talked about. But I mean, as someone who's giving feedback, I always want to make sure that my feedback is actually helping. It's actually useful for the person who's receiving it. And if we can become better at supporting them and giving feedback which helps them, then we should. Mm-hmm. Right. So
quite,
yeah. And
quite agreed. So maybe just one more workshop or plenary, yeah, and a quick synopsis.
Oh, it's so hard. Absolutely. I haven't talked about any plenaries, so maybe mm-hmm. I should do that since they're okay. supposed to be a big deal.
So the plenaries are the start of the day, right? The big ones, yeah.
Yeah, so I found all of them quite interesting. The one that I think was most interesting for me personally was the final plenary and conference closing, which was on environmental responsibility and ELT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a conversation between Siri Jones, Owen Llewellyn, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, mm-hmm. I'm so sorry, and Geoffrey Morocco, I think mm-hmm. I'm pronouncing mm-hmm. his name correctly too. And it was a conversation between these three professionals who have been working in ELT sustainability for a long time. People might recognize Owen Llewellyn's name from ELT Sustainable, which he's mm-hmm. been working on for, mm-hmm. I think, a decade now.
And Carrie from ELT Footprint, I believe.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. 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 It was really great. They were all coming from quite different contexts. And so there was a lot of discussion of, you know, how teachers can integrate environmental responsibility into their lessons and not just, you know, we've done the unit on the environment and now we're never going to talk about it again. And like small ways that we can incorporate it into our curriculum and our everyday teaching. Owen said that teachers should start from their strengths and encourage learners to participate and come to their own conclusions about environmental issues. So it's really important for teachers to, if we're going to talk about the environment, talk about environmental issues that actually affect the learners. You know, if the learners are living in an area which is affected by, for example, water shortages or droughts or issues like that, then you should be talking about it. If it's in the news, learners need to be able to talk about it in English as well as their own language. You know, they need to be able to have these discussions. And also, it's really important for teachers not to say what the conclusion of, you know, harming the environment is bad. And that's not
really and this productive. Is what we must do, right?
Yeah. When learners need to be able to recognize issues and brainstorm how they in their own lives and contexts can make an impact. You know, there are a million lessons about recycling, you know, and we can all recycle, but is that applicable in every single context? Like, do learners live in a place which has a recycling program that their local government runs? You know, how does that work? And Sari sort of followed that up by saying, you know, do what you know, because when we teachers stick to our hearts to something important, then we can do something meaningful with our learners. Like, don't worry about doing something right or wrong. Don't worry if you're not really informed about environmental issues, but do a little research and then just try to take the first step. Mm-hmm. So Sari was really trying to say, just try something and see if it works with them. I think it was Geoffrey who said that any age, any level, any ability can engage with the environment. You just have to make sure that you are using an issue which is relevant to them and meaningful, something that actually applies to their lives, something that they can do or use, and make sure that you're grading it to their level. National Geographic Publishing has books for all levels, so it must be possible to talk mm-hmm. about, mm-hmm. you know, the world, the environment, ecosystems, animals, world issues at any level, because they're doing it, publishing worldwide. So
QED.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll hear more from ELT Footprint in a future episode of DeveloPod, because it's a fascinating organization where I mm-hmm. believe teachers and materials writers and ELT professionals more widely can share ideas and navigate how to teach and what to teach of environmentalism. And it's a mm-hmm. really good sharing platform. So mm-hmm. we'll put the link to that for listeners at the end of this mm-hmm. On the show notes.
Super. Yeah. And also ELT Sustainable, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other kind of notable moments for you during IATF?
Something funny is it's really great that there are mindfulness sessions every morning to start the day for those who are interested in going to them. And every day I wanted to attend a mindfulness session, but every day I always had something else that I wanted to go to more. So that wasn't very mindful, was it?
Well, it was very mindful of the things you wanted to go and see.
It's true. I know that mindfulness sessions are going to continue. So hopefully next year when ITEFL's in Harrogate, I'll be attending next year because it's very close to where I live.
Hopefully you're continuing in a roving reporter style, even if informally, next year, and you'll be able to feedback. What advice perhaps would you give to people going next year, particularly those who've never been to a major conference like ITEFL before? Because I know it can be quite overwhelming, for instance. It can be quite difficult to decide what to go to because there's so much on offer. What advice would you give?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, before attending this year, ITEFL did a live stream video, which was a Facebook Live, which was streamed on Facebook and also on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it was a group of teachers and organizers getting together to give advice to people attending the conference, and especially first timers. So I watched that before coming, and okay, that was very helpful. So I really recommend everyone, if you're coming next year, it'll happen a week before, mm-hmm, probably. Mm-hmm. So check it out. Or also, you could also check out a previous year's ones.
Yeah, it's called How to Get the Best from the ITEFL Conference or something like that.
How to Make the Most of Your ITEFL Conference, I think.
Yeah,
so, yeah. Okay. It was great. It was very helpful. So a lot of the advice that I'm going to give, I actually got from there and put into practice, and I'm very grateful I did. But yeah, so here's my advice. Number one, wear comfortable shoes because you have to walk around a lot. Uh-huh. Sometimes you have to go from one end of the conference center to another.
Completely with you on that one. Number two?
Yeah. Water bottle. Make sure that you're drinking lots of water. Carry it around. There are some water bottle stations, so you can fill up. Yeah, that's really big. Snacks. Bring snacks. I brought granola bars and dried fruit. And some days I had sandwiches. They were really handy to sort of like woof down in between talks, or you know, if I've arrived early and it's 5 or 10 minutes till the talk starts, and I'm just sat there. And
snacks. I agree. I took some almonds and bananas. And tip four, I believe we're on.
Yeah, that is make a plan before you go. Now, some people are really like chilled out and they want to just look at what's on and decide in the moment. And that's totally cool for you. Great. That is not cool for me.
I find that quite stressful. Yeah.
Yeah. I like to know where I'm going and when. And also, I would sort of do my plan the night before. So I'd come home and I'd look through the schedule, be like, oh, I'm interested in this. And I plan out what was at what time and where they were.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that completely. Make a plan before, the night before, preferably, if not the morning before of the day of conference. But I would say for me, I don't know about other people, but for me, it's useful to leave some windows as well. Windows, either way, you just take some time out because it's quite full on, or you decide at the last minute, oh, I'm going to drop into that. And sometimes it's those last minute things, those last minute decisions that are actually quite fruitful, and you see something you wouldn't have expected to see.
Yeah, absolutely. So, having backups. Sandy Millen told me on my second day, because on my second day, 4 different talks that I wanted to go to were all canceled. Four of them. And she said to me, oh, Helen, it's because you're a newbie. You have to have backups. And I was like, okay. And so for the next 2 days, I made sure I had backups, was very useful. Yeah.
I might be wrong, but I think we're on tip number 5.
Yep. And I've got 6 total. So yeah.
Reel them off. I'll try not to interrupt. Go for it really quickly. You've got a minute to go.
Okay. Plan to meet people if you can. So if you've been speaking to people online, you want to see them, tell them you want to see them like a week or two before the conference and try to make a plan. There were a couple people I wanted to see and I didn't make plans to meet them, and we just didn't get to meet. So, you know, we're going to follow up on Zoom later on, but you know, I wish I had sort of said to them beforehand, hey, let's meet. And I'd like made a timetable to do that.
Good tip.
You know,
good tip. Number 6, I believe.
Yeah, last one. Attend socials if you want to meet new or like-minded people. Or also, the socials can be a good place to meet someone if you plan to meet them there ahead of time. For example, there's a get-together for first-time conference members, which I attended. There was also a get-together for the scholarship recipients, and I attended that. And it was really great to attend those and get to meet people. And then there's also lots of different events. You know, there's always a talk the first night on, you know, what to do in this location, like a bit of a tourism talk. There's, you know, music. There's a music night. There's a quiz night. Yeah, lots of stuff. If you're really into social activities, make sure you go to them, because half of the fun of conference is getting socialized with you know, these like-minded professionals.
Right. Good tips. Okay. Thank you so much for talking to us. Sounds like you've got a huge amount out of this conference, Helen. And I look forward to hearing about next year's conference. Maybe even meet you there.
Yeah.
Really, really lovely to hear your exuberance talking about what you've learned at this IOTEFL. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I encourage our listeners to apply for the Michael Bergman Scholarship. I will give you more information in a second.
Super.
Thanks, Helen. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Helen, and that maybe entices you to come to IOTEFL. Now, IOTEFL is in Harrogate this year, 2023, in the north of UK. And Tasia, who we'll hear from in a future episode, has already won the Michael Bergman Scholarship. If you'd like to enter for a scholarship for 2024, then entries will be open, I believe, from June 2023. So to apply, go to our website, tdsig.org, and then /scholarship. That's tdsig.org/scholarship. Look forward to seeing you in either Harrogate or in a future IOTEFL. Thanks so much for joining us. Bye for now.